Well, thank you very much, Asaf. It's a real pleasure to speak to the SPME membership today. I'm a big fan of this organization and want to congratulate you for the important work that you do. I can't say that this is going to be as exciting as you just advertised, but hopefully we can have a good conversation about this very timely topic. And just a word about the bipartisanship. One of the decisions that I made many, many years ago is to be totally nonpartisan. And actually nobody knows who I ever vote for in my institute, not even the president and chairman of my board of directors, because I think that it's really important in my position to be totally nonpartisan, which has been a formula that I think that has been helpful over the now 27 years that I've been director of the Washington Institute. I am, however, a very strong partisan when it comes to supporting U.S.-Israel cooperation. I believe that this is a partnership which is not just in Israel's benefit, but a partnership which advances American interests quite strongly. And so I approach the issue that we're talking about today, the question of annexation, with in that context and with some trepidation, because this is an extraordinarily odd moment for me, because annexation presupposes that the governments of Israel and the United States are on the same page. Annexation would not be a viable or a live issue were it not for the American incentive of recognition that is the key variable that has changed with the Trump administration and which puts annexation into an operational format. So it's with some trepidation that my remarks are strongly opposed to the idea of annexation, because in so doing, I'm coming out against, unusually for me, a prime example of U.S.-Israel strategic cooperation. But it is precisely because this is such an unusual example of that cooperation, an example that it is impossible for me to identify a strategic rationale, for which it is impossible for me to identify a strategic rationale that puts this in this unique category of U.S.-Israel strategic cooperation that I oppose. And I speak to this group. It's not as though I'm brandishing bona fides. Everybody, I respect the bona fides of everybody on this call, but it's not as though I've been a lifetime critic of certain measures by this government of Israel. I was a strong advocate, for example, of the move of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I was a strong opponent and urged senators to vote against the Iran nuclear deal. As a way to compel improvements in its terms. So if our two governments lose me as as an example of public opinion on this issue, and what I'd like to think is informed public opinion, I fear for how the reaction will be among less sympathetic corners of our politics and of politics in key capitals. So let me give a window into my thinking of the issue. For me, the basic question is why. Well, we can argue about the semantics. I'm happy to explain why I think annexation is a totally appropriate term. All that, we ultimately, this in my view, comes down to the question of why. Why exchange a not perfect, but not wholly unsatisfactory, surprisingly sustainable, reasonably tolerable status quo. Why risk the status quo for the unknown of annexation, for the risks of annexation? What strategic benefit does Israel derive from taking this move? I have spent weeks, months looking for that answer. Not, does Israel have the right to do this? We can discuss that. Not, is there a strong political, domestic political argument for this? I think it's actually much less than meets the eye, especially if you look at public opinion polls. But that's not even the issue. What strategic benefit does Israel derive from extending its law, extending its sovereignty, and annexing a substantial portion of the West Bank? And we can have an interesting discussion about, you know, different flavors of annexation, different percentages. But let's, for the purposes of this discussion, let's focus on just the basic question. What does Israel gain? So in the course of looking at this issue for many weeks, what I came up with is the argument of annexation advocates is that what Israel gains is a resetting of the fundamentals of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is the idea that the terms of an acceptable resolution have been carried away by the tide of politics in the last 20 years to a place that many Israelis cannot accept. And that only by taking this unilateral measure can Israel regain control of this process and redefine what is an acceptable and an unacceptable way to approach a final resolution of the conflict with the Palestinians. To be more precise, the argument that I heard from architects of this idea is that the world has moved left. The world has moved in a direction that considers, that doesn't consider the West Bank as disputed territory with legitimate claims from all sides, in which negotiations are a vehicle for Israel to find secure and recognized borders and the Palestinians to find an expression of sovereignty and self-determination. No, that's not what this is. Rather, that the world has moved into the direction whereby the territories themselves are fully Palestinian, rightfully so, and that at most, the peace process is merely a vehicle for the implementation of full Palestinian sovereignty with perhaps some accommodation for certain Israeli security interests, but those are really bumps in the road toward the execution of full Palestinian sovereignty over these territories. Where that is the direction that the world has moved, so say the annexationists, while Israeli politics has moved exactly in the opposite direction, that not only has Israel rightful security interests that need to be addressed in any final settlement, but over the last number of decades, the expansion of the settlement project, and the deepening of Israeli civilian life in the territories has given Israel a greater desire to hold on to parts of the territory, if not the entire territory, but certainly parts of the territory, beyond that which is solely needed even just for security measures. So as Israel moves in that direction, the world has moved in the opposite direction, and only annexation can stop this drift, reset the fundamentals, and begin from a new basis, a basis in which the world knows this percentage of territory is Israel's now and forever, and we can discuss the rest. The rest is open for negotiation. So that is that's the logic, to the extent that it exists, that's the logic of annexation. However, it is difficult for me to see how this succeeds. Recognition, border recognition, is not something that even the United States can provide Israel. Border recognition is something that only exists when the local parties accept it. Annexation does not create recognized boundaries. Annexation does not end Palestinian claims. Annexation does not resolve differences over these issues. But what it does do is it does end a 53-year policy that has had surprising longevity and success. Now, what has been that policy? People tend to forget this. It is a policy of advocating for Israel's presence in the territories as a legitimate legal occupier, the result of the defensive operations of the Six-Day War. That Israel's presence has always been legitimate. And that legitimacy gave expression, was found expression in Israel's never-ending search for peace, in Israel's continuous offering of ideas for resolving the conflict with Arab states and with the Palestinians, and with the commitment that came with the Oslo process not to alter the fundamental status of the territories. Now, annexation intrinsically suggests that that Oslo commitment no longer abides. Now, one can argue that the Palestinians long ago broke various aspects of their Oslo commitments. Actually, so too Israel did not fulfill all of its Oslo commitments. But neither party was so outraged at the reality of the Oslo framework that either party up until now decided to throw it away, specifically decided that it no longer applied. That wasn't the PA's view. The PA has groused about all sorts of things for years, but for the last 15 years, certainly since the end of the Second Intifada, the last 15 years, there has been a status quo in which the PA has operated under a self-governing authority, more or less basically like other Arab states operate in the Middle East. The Israelis have maintained total security control. There has been cooperation on some key issues. The Israelis have actually accustomed the world to incremental growth and settlements. And there has been essentially a peace situation, not happily, not satisfactory, but yet not so unsatisfactory that either side wanted to blow it up. This, however, changes that. It changes it in a legal sense, because Israel's argument now has to be, that the Oslo commitment not to change the fundamentals of the situation in the West Bank no longer applies. This is precisely what the PA wants the International Criminal Court to hear. Israel is, I mean, you can't make this up. Israel is making the case to the International Criminal Court that its commitment not to change the status no longer applies, its commitment to Oslo no longer applies, therefore the Palestinians are free to do all sorts of things. Israel is saying no longer are these just disputed territories where it has a claim, the opposite side has a claim, and we should sit around a table to negotiate. No, Israel would effectively be saying we are imposing our claim. And we are not in the process even necessarily ending our claim to other territories. We are merely suspending. If you look at the Trump language, we're merely suspending for a period of time additional settlement activity in part of the territory. Along the way, this is going to compel a series of negative outcomes. It's going to compel some reaction from the Palestinians that will be negative. We can determine how much. We can have a debate about that. It will compel negative response from the Jordanians, the party with the greatest intimate connection to the Palestinian issue, and we can talk about that, exactly what they will do. But it will be negative. It will compel Arab states to suspend, if not break off, their public normalization with Israel, as Youssef Oteba argued in Yediot last week. It will convince many in the international community that only punitive measures are now appropriate because the Israelis have gone a step too far. It will deepen the partisanship on Israel already in the United States, a partisanship which is real, but yet not unsalvageable, yet not determinative, and I'm happy to go into why that's the case. Look, I don't think the sky is going to fall. I don't think that Israel is going to be find itself alone tomorrow because of annexation. But annexation cannot but feed a series of negative trends, which will lead to the erosion of Israel's quite successful global status right now. And I keep coming back to the idea, for what? For what tangible gain? Yes, domestic politics. Yes, ideological satisfaction. Yes, you know, those issues, those purely domestic issues, they're beyond my my focus. But in terms of strategic rationale, for me, it is difficult to find. And for the United States, and this is where I end up, to have a partner who purposefully and knowingly shrinks its ability to operate in the region, purposefully and knowingly limits its strategic room for maneuver, purposefully and knowingly diverts attention from common threats and common dangers, like the Iran nuclear issue. This, to me, makes this an American issue, which is why this is not an example of, oh, the Israelis are doing something private and domestic, limited to themselves. That's not an acceptable position to take, in my view. This wouldn't be on the table were it not for U.S. policy, and this has an impact on U.S. interests in the Middle East, especially in the Levant. And so that's why I come back to its impact on the United States, and why, as a partisan in support of the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship, I urge my government to please reconsider its support for this step. And I hope that events and trends in the region will bring about a rethinking of this before a fateful decision to take this step is ultimately taken. So why don't I stop here? There's all sorts of nuances and micro topics that I didn't go into, but I'm happy to engage in this in any way that USOF and your colleagues would like to.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for that, Rob. That's great. And so with that, the floor is now open. Again, if you have a question, please click on the hand icon. I'll be able to unmute you, or you can type in your question. We have a few hands up, so let me start with Sharon, and we will go from there. Sharon, can you hear us? Sharon?
Oh, okay.
Yes, Sharon, go ahead.
Well, that's because I clicked on
the Sharon, can you hear us?
Yes, I'm sorry. I would like to pass, though. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. Thank you. Let's move on to the next question. Let's go to Shelley. Shelley, can you hear us? Okay, Shelley's not good. Alex, why don't you start us off while I maneuver this, if possible?
Sure.
Stunning people into silence.
Yes, exactly.
Let me start by thanking you for your extremely cogent and persuasive presentation. I think my question is really how you noted that there's been a status quo for 15 or so years. It sort of works, sort of. People, you know, there have been dramatic advances for Israel on the diplomatic front during that period, as I think arguably as a result of Netanyahu's explicit strategy of outreach towards Africa, towards Asia, and of course the Arab world. Were annexation not on the table, how long do you think this status quo could be maintained, given all the other things that are going on in the region and within Israel, within the specific Israeli-Palestinian relationship?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's an interesting question. Secretary of State Kerry liked to say that the status quo is unsustainable. Well, you know, 53 years later, the status quo is surprisingly sustainable. Now, we may all wake up one morning and it's not. That's the way the world works. But it would seem to me the argument has to be on the side of those, or the burden of proof has to be on the side of those who would suggest that its sustainability is urgently in question.
Let me just jump in. Couldn't it be argued that some of this annexation impulse is being driven precisely by a reaction to Kerry and the Obama administration, which did everything it could to change the status quo from the outside in?
Well, see, this argument could lead you in a totally opposite direction. If indeed they did everything they could to change the status quo, they failed.
Right.
I mean, the Israelis are no less in control of the territory today than they were at any point in the last 53 years. There's now nearly a half a million Israelis in the West Bank. I'm not referring to Jerusalem. I mean, I don't agree with the wisdom of all this, but the facts are indisputable. So if indeed they tried everything, well, they didn't try. They didn't succeed. And so, I mean, I actually think, as you intimated a moment ago, Netanyahu's strategy was remarkably successful. Why a new incarnation of Netanyahu who wants to chuck that strategy for the uncertainty of risk involved in this? That's the real question.
Great. We have, let me just, you know, we'll come back to that, but let me read a question here that we got from our friend and colleague, Steve Landis. Rob, Steve is referring here to the recent report that David Pollack released about the deterioration of the two-state solution in Palestinian public opinion. And, you know, of course, you know, he attributes in the report, which I'm sure you saw, about, you know, the messaging coming out of Hamas and Fatah, calling for the end of Israel as a separate state from the river to the sea, et cetera. So the opposition to annexation is centered on the damage that will be caused to the two-state solution. And so what Steve is asking is, where is the evidence that the PLO, Lebanon, Hamas understands what the two-state solution is about altogether? And maintaining...
Look, I'll be candid. I have no idea whether the PLO supports the two-state solution. All I know is what reality has been for years, which is Palestinians have operated in a self-governing authority that has more or less mirrored the sorts of feckless, it's basically in the middle of where Arab states are on efficiency, on corruption, on all sorts of things. It's better than some, worse than others. They haven't been so angered at the indignities that the Israelis impose on them that they've decided to throw it all off for violent revolt, not for 15 years. Actually, these have been the most peaceful 15 years that Israel has known in its history. Does the PA, where are Palestinians on the future of a two-state solution? I don't know. I totally recognize the poll data that my colleague Dave produced. I do think, my humble view is that leadership here makes all the difference. Not all the difference, a considerable difference. When the leaderships are as disparaging of territorial partition as the solution to this conflict as they are today, then it's no surprise if people are opposed to the idea. But the fact that they're opposed to the idea doesn't necessarily mean that they are opposed to that they're willing to take up arms and violently settle this in a way that is outside of some negotiating framework. So I'm not so sure what the so what is of the proposition.
Okay, fair enough. Just
one more thought.
Yeah,
I should say, there aren't that many people out there who like I do actually celebrate the status quo. People like, clarity. People of one sort or another. Solutionism is a term I use sometimes. I won't even go there. People like clarity. Right. And the current situation is, murky. It's gray.
Right.
Guess what?
Well,
you can live in gray. You can survive in gray. You can even thrive in gray for a long, long time.
Well, I mean, to that end, this is, a discussion that, I'm sure you've had over the years, and I've had, over the years with people like, for example, Khaled Abu Tawameh. So Khaled, would like to argue, who's been covering this and obviously, has covered the PLO and was actually a reporter for the PLO, in the early years before he changed and moved over. He, would continuously argues that the status quo is the best it's ever going to be. Because it doesn't force any party to change where they are. And he would also continue to argue that, things were better before peace, i.e. referring to Oslo, because it didn't change, there was much more collaboration, as we both know, as far as the more normalized relations, Israelis were shopping, and eating in Bethlehem. They were going, in the old days, even in the 80s, shopping in Khan Yunis, and things of the sort. And things got worse, when we started with the framework. And so, again, that's a voice that, Allah, your point as far as status quo wise, that people like an Abu Tawameh would argue that, let's leave it, if it's not broken, let's leave it where it's at.
Yeah, look, there are certain aspects of the way things were in the 70s and 80s that were better than today. As you refer to, the access ordinary Israelis, non-Arab Israelis would have to, West Bank cities and towns, which they don't have today.
Right.
But there, the trade-off there is Palestinian self-government. And my point was simply, you don't hear too many people. I don't think we hear enough of recognition of the value of this not wholly satisfactory, but not totally unsatisfactory status quo.
Fair enough. Let's go to Paul here, and let me unmute Paul. Paul, can you hear us? Paul, are you able to hear us? Paul? Paul muted himself. So let me go to BB's question that has written in until we're able to get Paul on the line. So BB Gertesman is asking, is it true that the Israelis are largely in favor of annexation while American Jews are largely against it? And if so, to what extent and why?
So public opinion polling on the issue only really began to pick up steam in the last month, surprisingly. So if you listen to advocates of annexation who one would have talked with in January, February, March, April, they will point to Israeli election results, which show that parties that support annexation collectively won a large majority. And they will infer from that that annexation itself is a popular position. Now, if you look at public opinion polls that only began asking what I'll call contextual questions, I'll explain that in a minute, began asking serious questions in the last 2-3 weeks, the polling data is very, very different. So for a few months, the only question they would ask is, do you support the extension of Israeli law into the territories? And when you ask something simple like that, people say, sure, why not? But it's when you begin to ask questions which have a net assessment attached. Do you support the extension of Israeli law if it means tension with the Arabs, if it means a suspension of the peace treaty with Jordan, if it means increased criticism from Israel's allies, or whatever, the numbers go down precipitously. And so what you get today, and I just was looking at some of the numbers before this phone call, fewer than half. There is no majority even of support for annexation. You get very low numbers of Israelis who think it's a priority. So if you ask Israelis to list their national priorities right now, it comes, I think, fourth or fifth, way down below dealing with the economic depression brought about by COVID and dealing with the health challenge and that sort of thing. It barely registers. Only a minority of Likud voters think that they should do this if it comes at the expense of peace with, renewed tensions with Jordan and peace with Jordan. So it is a fallacy to argue that large majorities of Israelis support this idea. That is simply not true.
Thank you. So let's go on to Sharon's question here. And this is, again, if you can, obviously more of the psychology of Bibi. So she is asking, so the de facto now that annexation will definitely lead to a one state. And is that what Bibi has had in mind for the last, decade or so? If you can speculate on reading Bibi Netanyahu's decision-making processes.
Yeah. It's a good question. I have no idea what's inside Netanyahu's mind or inside the mind of, unless somebody actually tells me what they're thinking. What I do know is that annexation will convince many, certainly in Arab countries, that Israel, that this is a step in the feared alternative homeland strategy, that this is a step toward, if not pushing, then taking so much territory in the West Bank that it makes a Palestinian, even a conceivable Palestinian state, inconceivable. We can put aside the idea whether the Palestinians want their own state. But having that as an option would many will now view this as taking it off the table. Now, I don't think the Israelis want to incorporate, I know extremely few Israeli political leaders who think that it is wise to incorporate 2+ million Palestinians within the sovereign boundaries of the state of Israel. Is there a realistic two-state outcome that can emerge after unilateral Israeli annexation? I'm regrettably quite skeptical, and so so this, this fundamental paradox, I think, will impress itself upon Israelis more and more in the coming years. I mean, I'm not one to, I hope everybody takes this the right way. I don't wring my hands about, the fate of this, of, of, uh, of Israel. I think the Israelis ultimately, you know, will find a way to sustain, you know, their Jewish democracy. But I fear they have, by doing this step, will have complicated that task immeasurably. And along the way, will have eroded some of the important strategic partners that are essential for Israel's defense and security as it pursues that that challenge.
Fair enough. Thank you. All right. So I have a few questions that have come in. Let me try to. All right. So let's go to Shelley's question, and then I'll go to Francine's question. So Shelley's asking, of course, you know, is the July date a hard and set time as far as the timeline for this? And the next question related, of course, to the obviously a topic that many of us deal with in this circle is, of course, what is all of this doing to the global BDS movement and how all this is impacting? Now, of course, we know that everything that happens current event wise feeds into all of this, but obviously we're looking at, you know, today, you know, when you're looking at, you know, what I think that, you know, many of us see that the environment of the riots and Black Lives Matter and a lot of the actions that we're observing today as far as taking down statues and things of the sort is a lot of the microcosm of what many of us see and deal with on American college campuses. But as far as, you know, the cultural kind of political environment at large, how does that impact you know, this decision-making processes? Does it feed in anywhere, given the fact that, you know, I'm adding this, you know, Israel has finally, I would say, you know, understands that BDS is actually an existential threat to the state of Israel on a variety of levels, given the fact that they have a ministry now, the incoming ambassador is the former, you know, inaugural minister of that ministry. So if you could, you know, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So first on the timing, I mean, July 1st is a self-declared deadline. There's no objective reason why something has to happen on July 1st, except that BB has created this sort of image of inevitability of action on or around that date. Now, there have been talk about, you know, incremental annexation, doing it in stages, doing pieces. And there are, I think, very intensive discussions going on between blue and white and Likud, and between and blue, white, Likud in the White House on that. I can't say that I'm privy to it. I would not be surprised if the ultimate annexation, if it happens, is less than the full 30%. Although I will tell you, you know, just playing out the decision tree, if you wanted, for those of you who do these sorts of things, the decision tree would suggest that if you're going to take the step, you're better off taking a big step than a little step, because a little step gets you even less gain, and much of the and you know, much of the pain. So my hunch is that they're likely to move either in a direction of a fairly substantial step or a total postponement. I could be wrong on that. It won't be the first time. In terms of the second question, look, this is really serious. It is difficult to imagine how annexation does anything other than feed into the global critique of Israel. I can't imagine it doing anything but that. I can't imagine it domestically doing anything but deepening the partisanship on Israel and of feeding those trends within the Democratic Party that are deeply critical of Israel, trends which are significant but not dominant, and not it's certainly not foreordained that they will become the dominant trend. If you truly viewed BDS as a strategic threat to the state of Israel, it is difficult to square that assessment with pursuing this policy. Because this policy, and I say this with the most profound regret, this policy is only going to feed the worst instincts of the worst people. And it will make it much more difficult for mainstream defenders, people of goodwill, people of conviction. It will make it just much more difficult for those people of goodwill and conviction to stand up in support of the state of Israel. Now, we will do it. We will do it. I will continue to do it while critiquing and condemning this particular policy. But it will become more difficult in various countries and in various parts of the political spectrum to take that position. And so I truly hope that the advocates of this proposal have fully and adequately factored all this into the gain risk assessment before taking this decision.
Great. Thank you. Let me move on to a question that has been circling around, and I'll try to summarize what our friend Francine is asking. I guess this goes to the terminology, of course, and obviously you write about this a lot in your report, but the language that is being used as far as annexation and the issue of sovereignty. We just recently marked the anniversary of the San Remo Agreement, and there's a great deal of conversation as far as the legal ownership of the land, and there's a great deal of, many of us have discussed how the language of the Arab-Israeli conflict is being discussed. Is this language does that help the conversation as far as the character of the state of Israel? One could argue, and I've argued myself over the years, that the way Israel adapts certain phraseology vis-a-vis occupation, intifada, and others does not help making the case outside of Israel. But maybe can you touch on the issue between the annexation sovereignty debate that's playing out here, that's being discussed as a result of all of this?
Yes, I'm very familiar with the argument that this somehow does not constitute annexation because Israel has had legitimate claims, sovereign claims to the territory, and it's merely now exerting its longstanding sovereign claim. Which is based on international resolutions such as San Remo. Doesn't cut mustard in international politics today. And it hasn't so for 53 years. It hasn't since the government of Israel quite reasonably adopted a position in 1967 that it was the legal occupier of these territories pending a negotiated resolution. And its entire goal for years was to get the world to agree to the idea that the resolution of the conflict was through direct negotiations between the parties. This is what Israel labored decades for, and it won. It succeeded. People don't recognize, people forget. This was a huge achievement. The whole idea of 338, 242, 338, the idea that there'll be some international conference that will impose its peace on Israel. No, the Israelis labored for decades to convince the world that the solution to this conflict was direct negotiations between the parties. And then, having succeeded, now they suggest, no, I'm sorry, as reasonable and tolerable as the situation was pending that final negotiation, we're going to take a unilateral measure to change all that. This is pulling defeat from the jaws of victory, in my view. Having discussed this issue with U.S. legal advisors to administrations going back 30 years, they are uniformly of the position that this action is precisely what the term annexation is appropriate for. I'm sorry that on this issue, I just cannot support the idea that the language is wrong. Actually, I support the traditional Israeli view, not the view that is being advanced just right now. I support the traditional Israeli view of the last 53 years of Israel as the legal occupier, pending a resolution through direct negotiations.
Thank you. Fair enough. And thank you for that. Let's see if we can get Charles, unmute Charles here and ask his question. Charles, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
That's a natural segue. What if we change the term from occupation to the word or the notion of liberation? What do the majority of Palestinians want? Do they want to live like Israelis? Or do they want to live like under Abbas rule? And second question would be, what happens when Abbas is finally terminated? Presumably naturally, but who knows for sure?
Thank you.
These are two very interesting speculative questions. One, I think it's fair to say that that Abbas will eventually pass the scene. Arab leaders live a long time, but they eventually pass, and there will be new Palestinian leadership, and that leadership will either soon or eventually provide a new opportunity to rethink where the Palestinian national movement is going in terms of its aspirations and its relationship with Israel. I would like to think that with the passage of time, the Palestinians will, like Israelis, have become more open to different win-win options. So far, that hasn't been the case. In the meantime, the not unsatisfactory status quo is a reasonable alternative. As to Palestinians being liberated, I don't know what that term doesn't really, in my view, apply to the current situation. The Palestinian Authority is in a legal relationship with the State of Israel. Both sides have complaints against the other in terms of fulfillment of their various responsibilities. I don't see where this concept of liberation comes in. They don't need to be liberated from anything.
Thank you. So Rob, here's a question that I've had, you mentioned it in your earlier remarks, and I wanted to, in some of the time that we have left, if you could address that as well. You've known and you've studied Jordan for a very long time. You know the monarchy, you've known Abdullah's father. Can you talk a little bit about, what's going on the Jordanian street today? As a result, if this moves along, this will have a significant impact, obviously, to Jordan, and a little bit of insight into Jordanian politics and the monarchy and its government as it relates to all of this. I think, that would be great to touch on, given your expertise.
Sure. The fairly common and I'm afraid to say, a bit superficial view is Jordan as a demographically country with a whose population is of majority Palestinian origin will be up in arms at this. The Jordanian population will be up in arms at this affront to Palestinian nationalism, and will force the king to take measures to harmful to the Jordanian-Israeli relationship. I think that doesn't really quite grasp the real political dynamics inside the kingdom. It is true to a certain extent. But what is more important is the political identity and the political fears of the Transjordanian elite, largely tribal elite, that occupy roles of leadership and authority in the intelligence, the army, the significant government ministries, etc. They're the ones who are the most concerned about the, and you can say it's fantasy, but to them it's very real, about the idea of a greater Israel philosophy that sees in Jordan the alternative homeland for the Palestinian people, and sees Jordan as the repository of a solution to the Palestinian conflict. They're the ones who would fear the most the idea that the Israelis are, how they would view it, are killing any option for the Palestinians to have some measure of self-determination in the West Bank, which would, in their view, force Palestinians to turn eastward and to exert their claims for self-determination inside Jordan. This is a morbid fear of this East Bank elite, and they would take it out on the Hashemite ruler on whose watch this would happen. And so the palace, in my view, is as much concerned about disaffection within the elite that really run the operations of this country as they are by the Palestinian majority that has been actually quite quiescent for decades. And it's that now some advocates of annexation say, the Jordanians really want Israel to be along the border, and they're just play acting and mouthing their criticism of this move, but really they want the IDF along the border. Again, this misses a key piece of the story. Yes, tactically, the Jordanians are not enamored of the idea that Palestinian security forces would control the border, and much prefer a situation in which Israeli security forces are the ones that have ultimate security control in the Jordan Valley along the border. But ultimate security control is different than sovereignty. Ultimate security control is something that in certain circumstances can even be worked out with Palestinian approval. A sovereign claim at the expense of Palestinians is a zero-sum situation. And that would trump whatever benefits. I mean, the negative aspect of that, of doing this against Palestinian will in such a way that it's likely to prevent any possible emergence of some Palestinian entity that would give Palestinians an outlet west of the border, that trumps any benefit it would be of the IDF being along the border. And so for Jordan, there's a hierarchy of needs here. Yes, they like the idea of Israeli security control, but they dislike even more the idea of Israeli sovereign takeover of territory against the will and at the expense of Palestinians, namely annexation. So it's a much more nuanced position than most people understand. And it really feeds why the Jordanians, alone among Arab states, I think take annexation as a serious threat to their own security.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Rob, and I appreciate obviously the inside dissecting of Jordanian politics, which I think is very important to understand what's happening on the Jordanian street as well. I want to keep to our time, and I know you're short on time today as well, Rob, but I really want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to everybody today. I want to thank everybody again for joining us this morning. This is obviously a complex issue that has a lot of emotions, a lot of politics that are playing out that we're seeing, and we are doing our best to provide all sides to give an inside understanding of what the political and cultural ramifications are to all of this going forward. So, Rob, really, I thank you again. Alex, I want to thank you as always for joining us, and of course, I want to thank everybody here who joined us this morning.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you as always. And everybody have a good day. Stay safe and healthy. And we will talk again soon.